frustrated. The seat became vacant after a conservative ally of Johnson stepped down over breaking lobbying rules. The prime minister has been hit by several setbacks and scandals in recent weeks, including a surging Omicron variant and tanking approval ratings. He's also particularly plagued by recent allegations about his government staff attending Christmas parties last year in violation of COVID restrictions. Johnson has denied that any rules were broken and has ordered an inquiry. Joining us now from London is Said Puruza with more details on this, in what, by many cases, devastating loss for the Conservatives. Said?
It definitely is, Bardia, a devastating loss for the Conservatives, and it is really has come as a shock to members of the Conservative Party, particularly because it's happened at the very heart of Conservative territory. As you said earlier, these are areas where the Conservatives have had enormous majorities for decades and decades, and for that to happen, for such a massive electoral swing to happen to the Liberal Democrats, really is a shocker. And some are saying this was not necessarily a vote for the Lib Dems, rather a vote against the Conservatives, a warning shot to them to get their act together, for this government to get its act together. And what is really very, very important is the scale of this change that has taken place. They had more than 23,000 lead, and now the Lib Dems have managed to turn that around. So the scale of it is very important. Partly it's got to do with what's been happening over the past few weeks. For example, the stories of the parties that took place last year, this time, that we continue to endlessly hear about, the fact that there were images of the Prime Minister Boris Johnson's own advisors and laughing at the public, making a mockery of the guidelines that they themselves set, and the public went to such great lengths to adhere to. And also stories of how the Prime Minister couldn't afford refurbishing his own residence at number 10 Downing Street and had to ask a Conservative Party donor to fork over £100,000 to fit that bill for him. And aside from all of that, Bardia, we're in the middle of a public health emergency. And some of the messaging coming out of Downing Street has really been confusing. We have seen, for example, some of that reflect in members of the government contradicting the country's chief medical officer in the past few days. And so what is happening right now is members of the Conservative Party are asking the question about this prime minister, whether or not he is fit to stay in power. Can he lead them through the next election to victory? And of course, there is no settled view on that. The vote seems to be split. Some of the MPs saying that he is still a winner, that he can deliver if given the time. But there are others who are saying, in their words, that lepers cannot change their spot, that perhaps it is time to look for an alternative to Boris Johnson. And you see, the bucket of bad news pouring over Boris Johnson does not stop there. There are two investigations that are ongoing as we speak, one into the his apartment refurbishing, and also allegations of parties or into Christmas Gate, parties that allegedly took place last year. The outcome of those inquiries out soon, and in the words of some analysts and members of the Conservative Party as well, he has received two big blows of late. One, the rebellion by members of his own party on the question of whether or not to introduce a more strict restrictions in light of the Omicron variant ripping through the population, more infections being announced every day so far, and with things even getting worse and breaking more records, according to the chief medical officer, in the coming weeks and months, and also this election defeat. And it seems that if this prime minister and his government receive another blow as potent as these two, he's going to be out, Artyom.
All right, thanks a lot, Saeed Press TV. Saeed Puruza joining us from the British capital, London. But however, joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have journalist and political analyst Fra Hughes joining us from Belfast. And also senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, is joining us from New York. Let's start off with Mr. Williams in New York. Sir, how did the Conservatives lose one of their safest seats to the Lib Dems?
Complete incompetence. The visible signs of lying and dissimulation, the abuse of privilege, attempts to lie to the public. It's quite a big rap. The amazing thing is it's taken this long to turn out. But you have to put it in the context that this time last year, people in Britain were not going to hospitals to bid farewell to their family when they were dying. They weren't going to hospitals when mothers were having children. Families were not able to see each other during the holiday season because they were obeying the laws that the regulations laid down by the government, whose members were carousing and cavorting in number 10 Downing Street. So this is really sort of playing the fiddle while Rome burns. It's got an extra resonance. And of course, it's on top of increasing visible and irrefutable signs of incompetence on the part of Boris Johnson. He has an assembly of charlatans and money makers, confidence tricksters, people who lie regularly, people who are looting the public purse for contracts, continual reservations and revelations about his ministers making money on COVID contracts to produce useless cures, useless equipment. It really is amazing that he's lasted this long. And part of the reason for that, which is revealed here, is the complete incompetence of the opposition. I mean, Keir Starmer has all the charisma of a cold rice pudding, and it shows that it's one of the reasons why Labour was trashed. But no one's voting for the Liberal Democrats. The Liberal Democrats have, for many years now, been a party where you say none of the above by ticking next to them. On the few occasions they've had any responsibility, was in the coalition with the Conservatives, where they're every bit as big. It was a Liberal minister who privatised the Royal Mail, for example, the post office, when he was in the coalition. So they've got much to answer for, but they managed to evade responsibility because it was the coalition, and people are forgetting that. They're coming back to it. They are now that none of the above column.
But sure.
It really is difficult to work out where things will go. One of the signs that some commentators have assumed is this may mean that the Brexit coalition that brought Boris Johnson in there might be losing its steam. That people might realise that there's more to life than Union Jacks and square sausages and any of the other trivia that he was played such a part in promulgating during the Brexit campaign.
Mr. Hughes in Belfast, how big of a setback is this for Boris Johnson and his Tories in the views of many? The event in North Shropshire could be the beginning of the end for the Tory rule. What do you think?
I think it's very easy to jump on the bandwagon that says having lost a safe Conservative seat that they've held for over 200 years, it's a damning indictment of the government. It's a damning indictment of Boris Johnson's leadership. But I think we should also bear in mind that it's only 2 years ago that Boris Johnson won a landslide victory on behalf of the Conservative Party. They gained a net gain of 48 seats, and they had 43.6% of the popular vote. So we're in halfway through the parliamentary five-year cycle. We are in the middle of a pandemic. It's been handled appallingly by Boris Johnson and his government. I think a lot of the backlash that we've seen in North Shropshire is actually coming from the fact that the incumbent MP had to resign because of his lobbying tactics. So he was seen as an untrustworthy person within the Conservative Party holding that particular seat on behalf of the Conservative Party, and it is a reflection of the Conservative government. And and the corruption that seems to have embedded itself so deeply in the heart of the government. But considering that Boris Johnson turned a red wall into a blue wall in the north of England, I think a lot of the people that have been elected with Boris Johnson in 2019 should show him some loyalty going forward. There's no election until 2024. We've seen peerages for to be bought. We have seen cash for questions. We have seen passports for sale. There's always been corruption in government. There's always been a backlash during the governmental cycle. And I think Boris Johnson could ride this out unless there is a leadership battle, which is more to do with the internal machinations of the Conservative Party than it is anything to do with this latest electoral defeat or where he stands in the polls of public opinion.
Ian Williams, Conservative Party Chairman Oliver Dowden, said, "I know that the voters of North Shropshire are fed up and they wanted to give us a kicking. We've heard that message loud and clear." What message was that exactly, and what are the Conservatives going to do about it?
Well, I think from the point of view of the Conservative chairman and the others, the big problem was Boris Johnson and his colleagues got caught. Not that they did it, they got caught. This government and this generation of politicians have few, if any, ethical scruples whatsoever about doing what they do. It's getting caught in public. And they haven't got caught as often because they have had to deal with, they haven't had to deal, in fact, with any type of vigorous press. What they've had to deal with was a press that is overwhelmingly an Amen corner and has supported them through thick and thin and made apologies for them. I gathered the Sun's website this morning, the Murdoch press, didn't even mention the by-election loss. It led off on far more other important things. So it's typical of the misleading from the media. But Conservative Party leadership isn't designated by the public, isn't designated even by the mass of Conservative members. We're quite right, it's the people who were just elected on his coattails. When they think that Boris Johnson is going to lose them their safe seats and their sinecures and their access to power and their ability to dip the public purse, that's when there'll be a country house conclave somewhere. All of his old mates from the public schools in Oxbridge will get together for a gathering one weekend, and Boris will be carried out on a stretcher with a knife in his back. It's what happened to Margaret Thatcher. It's what happened to all his previous incumbents who passed their vote-by date in the Conservative Party. They don't do it on popular revolts. It's done behind back doors. You know, the butler never did it, but someone in the Conservative Party will have done it, and he will be forced to resign. Whether he goes to the next election or not, if he does, it will be fatally flawed. But he's saved by one redeeming feature, is that who else is there? There aren't any serious contenders in the Conservative Party, because they're all every bit as corrupt and ineffectual as he is. There's sure. In the Labour Party, I mean, I've never seen such an appallingly mediocre lineup. Regardless of what their plain politics are, and most of them evade the politics completely, they are complete mediocrities. I wouldn't elect them to a parish council. And the Liberal Democrats, their only benefit, as I said, is they're the box that you say, I don't like any of them. So it doesn't matter who they put up, but people will vote for them rather than vote for Keir Starmer or Boris Johnson.
Mr. Hughes.
So it really is an abysmal state of British politics. Without vision, the politicians may as well perish.
We'll get back to you in a minute, Ian Williams. Mr. Hughes, Boris Johnson says that he takes responsibility, personal responsibility, for his party's disappointing results in North Shropshire. He said he totally understands why people are frustrated in the district. Talking about the effect of that, will we see a new and refined Boris Johnson after this, or will it be the same plethora of mistakes?
I think Boris has been defined by his failures in politics as much as his successes. He's been forced to resign from different positions within the party in the past. I think the way forward for Boris, he's a bungling idiot who bumbled his way to the top of the tree of the British political elite within the Conservative Party. He's like a Pooh Bear character who seems to stagger from one kind of crisis to another. I think really what you'll see from Bars going forward is he'll have to try and rein in some of the people that are leading him into these debacles. I mean, they're claiming that a lot of the flack he gets is about the Christmas party that apparently he didn't attend. And then again, there is this corruption that's seen within the party that I'm not saying he's not associated with, but there's been no public outcry about him personally being involved in this. So I think he needs to, I think what he needs to do is rally the troops. He'll have to take like a head count of who supports him, who's maybe out to get him in a kind of parliamentary political coup, try and rally the wagons, and maybe do a cabinet reshuffle. Isn't that what you do when you're in trouble as a prime minister? You decide who's got your back, and you put them in positions of power in order to protect your own inner sanctum within parliament. So that's what I would see. Maybe a reshuffle. Maybe throwing, maybe trying to throw more money at the NHS in order to buy more votes and buy more popularity going forward. But I don't think it matters on one level actually who's in charge. If Boris Johnson went tomorrow, the Conservative Party domestic and foreign policy wouldn't change. And for a working class person who's on minimum wage, for a refugee seeking asylum, and for someone who's on an NHS waiting list, whoever runs the Conservative Party will make no material difference to their lives.
Ian Williams, we can't talk about Boris Johnson's government and the Conservatives without mentioning Brexit. Now, I was listening to some interviews earlier prepping up for the show, and the Tories, they feel that they've delivered on the bigger issues, for example, getting Brexit done. But Brexit is still a spider web of ambiguities, disagreements, economic setbacks. How did they deliver on Brexit when the deal itself has turned into a reason of dissatisfaction among the British public?
Well, you know, Brexit was a mixed thing. It meant different things to different people. There's a genuine working class patriotism in Britain that had been fermented to regard everything as European interference. And many of the things Europe was actually protecting, many working class people like the unions and other, well, forms of democracy against the locals, the local rapacious conservatives. So it's very mixed, but the message coming across was it was patriotic. Now, what's patriotic about having a bumbling idiot of an Etonian who is on the verge of pushing Northern Ireland out, as you would appreciate from there, out of the Union, and consequently bringing possibly Scotland and Wales out as well? There's nothing patriotic about this at all. And of course, he's completely silent on the issue of Wales, Scotland, and in fact, the north of England. I mean, his is a home county government. It's a regional government, even with the famous Red Wall going.
All right, Mr. Hughes, when we're talking about Brexit, the Conservatives feel they've delivered, but looking at the outcome of it, maybe it's the opposite.
Well, they have delivered in that they have technically taken the United Kingdom, or England, Scotland and Wales, out of the European Union. Now, the fact that the Northern Ireland remains part of the single market for the economy and for exports and stuff because of the Good Friday Agreement, and they're not wanting to have a hard border on the island of Ireland, so the border is in the British Channel. I think people voted to leave the European Union on many different levels. It was sold as many different things, as our friend has said, to many different people. It has failed in some respects because the British economy is faltering. With the pandemic, you see, there's been a convergence of different things that have happened. Britain leaving the EU alongside the pandemic. With the pandemic, we have tens of thousands of people, taxi drivers, lorry drivers, people involved in the hospitality industry, all kind of laid off, found different jobs. So there is an issue with bringing goods into Britain outside of the border control issue, because there's a shortage of drivers, because people left that particular employment because of COVID, and because the jobs just didn't exist. So Britain's suffering from a lack of imports. There have been queries around foodstuffs on the shelves in and on the British supermarkets. But we can see that as inflation picks up and the interest rates begin to bite and people's incomes begin to falter, I think on an economic level going forward, Britain is definitely going to struggle in the next couple of years. And I think that could have a profound effect on the government itself going forward.
Sure. Mr. Williams is back with us for one last question. Ian, I know you addressed this a little earlier before, but I want you to look into your crystal ball and give us a prediction. Do you think that Boris Johnson will be prime minister and leader of the party as Britain comes to the next general election? Very briefly, if you may, because we're running out of time.
Well, no. He can reshuffle his cabinet, but, I mean, what? How can you reshuffle something when every card in the pack is a joker? He really has no... He's driven out all the substantial people, or they've walked out holding their noses in disgust at his behaviour. All of the, you know, the Tories of principle and ethics. I often find that difficult to say. But there are people, and he's driven them all out. What he's surrounded himself is what in British parlance we call flyboys and con men. And women, who are visibly disdainful of the common people around them. They are not populists. Brexit was a populist cause, but these people aren't populists. They have profound disdain for the voters, and it showed with every pronouncement. So, I think he's going to be hard put, the Tory party is going to be hard put to find a credible alternative, but they will still try to get rid of him because he's got too much radiation attached to him.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Journalist and political analyst Frog, he's joining us from Belfast. And thanks to senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, joining us from New York. Also, a special thanks to our for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
الذي له ملك السماوات والأرض ولم يتخذ ولدا ولم يكن له شريك في الملك ولم يكن له شريك في الملك وخلق كل شيء فقدره تقديرا.
He to whom belongs the dominion of the heavens and the earth, and who has not taken a son, and has not had a partner in dominion, and has created each thing and determined it with precise determination.
Brothers and sisters, the verse under discussion was the second verse of Surah Al-Furqan, الَّذِي لَهُ مُلْكُ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ, He to whom belongs the dominion of the heavens and the earth. وَلَمْ يَتَّخِذْ وَلَدًا, He has not taken any son. وَلَمْ يَكُنْ لَهُ شَرِيكٌ فِي الْمُلْكِ, He has not any partner in his dominion. وَخَلَقَ كُلَّ شَيْءٍ, He has created everything. فَقَدَّرَهُ تَقْدِيرًا, Then he ordered them in due proportions. Previously, we said that not only the calculated stable system of the world is among the strong reasons of monotheism, among the reasons of recognition of the Almighty Allah, but also its exact measurement is another clear reason to that. For example, when we look at the density of the Earth atmosphere, we understand that it is to the extent that it allows cosmic rays pass as much as the growth of plants need, and all harmful microbes are destroyed in the atmosphere, and only beneficial vitamins are created by them. So there are various vapors that have come out of the depth of the Earth during many centuries. Nevertheless, the air of the Earth does not get polluted, and it is always well balanced for the continuity of man's life. The great machine that creates and keeps such strange balance is the very seas and oceans from which vital and nutritional materials, rain and moderation of air and plants, and finally man himself originate. Every person who is able to understand must understand the importance and the crucial role they are playing, and he must thank it for its various favors. على مر الزمان تألقا
وأضاء للدنيا طريقا. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The second point regarding this verse, dear listeners, is the strange proportion and very exact balance that is between oxygen and carbon acid gas. These creations make animal and vegetable life, and this balance it is that has attracted the attention of all thinkers and scientists and make them think about it. The importance of carbonic acid gas is still uncovered to many people. It must also be mentioned that carbonic acid gas is the gas that is used for making fizzy drinks. It is a gas that is really dense and is fortunately near the surface of the earth, and it separates from oxygen uneasily with problem. When a piece of wood is set on fire, for example, wood which includes oxygen, hydrogen and carbon is analyzed chemically, and carbon will be mixed with oxygen very quickly, and the result is that carbon acid gas is created. Its hydrogen is quickly with oxygen mixed, and water vapor will be created. Smoke is pure carbon which is not mixed up. So when you breathe, you inhale some oxygen, blood takes it into all places of the body, and oxygen burns food in various cells, but it burns them really slowly and with a weak heat. Its vapor and carbonic acid gas goes out. Carbonic acid gas that is created by burning of food in cells returns to the lung, and with your later breathings, it gets out of your body. So all living creatures inhale oxygen and exhale carbonic acid gas. So this is one kind of proportion that the Almighty Allah has created in the system of creation. The exact balance between oxygen and carbonic acid gas. So this is only one example of the ending part of the verse where it says, وَخَلَقَ كُلَّ شَيْءٍ فَقَدَّرَهُ تَقْدِيرًا. He created everything and then he ordered them in due proportions. He has precisely defined their proportions and administrations. We'll talk about this second verse more, God willing, dear listeners, in the next program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Cinema Verite is the only festival in Iran that honors documentary filmmakers. The week-long cinematic event closed with an award ceremony in Tehran and prized the top documentaries of the year by filmmakers from Iran and the world. There's no limit for the themes of the entries. They can cover the sufferings of war-ravaged nations or deal with the socio-economic impacts of the coronavirus. Among the films that received an award this year was Ali Reza Memaryani's Broken Bones, The feature documentary narrates a bone setter's concern about wildlife in Iran's southern Hormuz Island and his continuous effort to raise awareness of the critically endangered local deer that are falling victim to human intervention in their habitat. It's the 15th edition of Cinema Verite. Last year, it was held online due to the coronavirus pandemic, and this year, the films were screened both online and in theaters. 551 films were submitted to the Cinema Verite Secretariat, out of which 179 works were selected and put to contest. Foreign laureates were not present in the festival due to the pandemic, and their awards were handed to representatives from their country's embassies. Documentaries must glue the audience to their seats with true yet touching stories instead of fiction, and with genuine scenes instead of visual effects. So docs that nabbed the Cinema Verite Award are definitely worth the top of the list of our must-watch films. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The spokesman for the Yemeni army, Yahya Saria, says they have carried out another retaliatory attack against several targets in Saudi Arabia. He said the Yemen military struck aircraft hangars at the King Khalid Air Base in Asir region and other sensitive targets in Jizan with five ballistic missiles.
This operation is part of the campaign to put pressure on the Saudi enemy because it only understands the language of force, and the silence of the international community encourages the Saudi regime to shed Yemeni blood. We are carrying out military operations to make the Saudi regime understand that it must stop its airstrikes that are killing civilians all over the country. And we will continue to target Saudi facilities until the war stops.
Saria said the attack came in response to the escalation of airstrikes by Saudi Arabia against Yemeni civilians. He vowed larger attacks unless Riyadh stops its ongoing war and siege.
These attacks come in the context of responding to the crimes of the Saudi enemy and the Saudi escalation in targeting civilians with air raids, whether in Sana'a or in other provinces. The Yemeni retaliatory attacks have penetrated the Saudi airspace and paralyzed the Saudi military. It is our right to respond to Saudi Arabia until the war and siege stop.
Recently, Saudi Arabia has been intensifying its airstrikes across Yemen and killing more civilians, including children. This has pushed the Yemeni army to launch further operations deep inside the kingdom.
Yemenis believe that the army has the right to hit back at those killing Yemeni women and the children and violating the sovereignty of their country. They say Riyadh should come to realize that the more attacks it conducts against Yemeni civilians, the more painful retaliatory strikes will be carried out against Saudi facilities. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
French President Emmanuel Macron didn't give a press conference until more than 2 years into his presidency, but he gave a two-hour televised interview shortly after the publication of the first poll, which shows him losing in the second round of the April election. The primary of the mainstream conservative party recently selected Valérie Pécresse, a former budget minister under Nicolas Sarkozy. And a new poll has her beating Macron 52-48 in the final round.
The traditional conservatives are bouncing high in the polls, thanks to the buzz from being newly united around a single person. They've lost a lot of votes in 2017 due to their candidates' perceived corruption. But with a restructured party and message, the rumors of their total demise may have been premature.
In 2017, the conservative candidate, François Fillon, was disgraced by a tremendous scandal over fake jobs, and yet he still almost made the second round. Many say the poll is a reminder of the historic strength of the mainstream conservative party, and also of Emmanuel Macron's almost permanently low approval ratings.
The one thing this poll makes clear is that Pécresse will at least be among the top three candidates of the first round. For her to advance, she really needs the support of Marine Le Pen to crumble, and also to attract many of Macron's dissatisfied voters, but it's too early to say if that will happen.
Pécresse hasn't come out of nowhere, but few expected that she would be in this position. She is often considered the conservative most similar to Macron, so a Pécresse-Macron final round won't offer many arguments in terms of policy. In the interview, Macron rejected his nickname, President of the Rich, but also promised that his re-election will bring right-wing changes to pensions that could cost him with older voters. He repeatedly admitted that he has made mistakes in his comportment, but not in his policies, and claimed that the corona pandemic made him more sensitive to the needs of the average person. Many said the interview appeared like a campaign speech, but Macron has still not yet declared if he is running for re-election. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Turkey's central bank voted to lower the interest rate of the country once again from 15% to 14%. This has directly affected the lira, which reached a record low of 15.5 right after the announcement. The Turkish lira has lost 50% of its value against the US dollar since the beginning of this year. In a trial to drag the attention of the public from the drop in lira value, Turkish president finally announced the raise in minimum wage after long negotiations between the government and opposition. Tayyip Erdogan said the increase would be 50%, making the minimum wage 4,253 Turkish lira.
The increase in minimum wage is 50%, the highest raise in the last 50 years. I believe that with this increase, we have shown our determination not to crush our employees in the face of price hikes.
Analysts refer to the public anti-government protests, saying people are complaining from the price hikes, the drop in lira value and inflation. However, instead of controlling the prices and solve the lira problem, the government chose to raise the minimum wage, which business owners are not very happy about, since they are already not meeting ends due to the economic situation in the country.
The increase in the minimum wage solves the problem just for right now. But if the inflation will keep staying higher like this, then in the long term, in a couple of months, the raise in the prices will eat the raise in the inflation and people will get poorer. Then it is for sure they will react against the AK Party in the elections. This may be the end of Erdogan era. What Erdogan hopes, they will not only increase their minimum wage, but they will also control the inflation by more production, by more export, then they will also control the value of Turkish lira, then the inflation rate.
Investors and economists have been calling for the government to increase interest rates. However, it seems President Erdogan is sticking to his new plan, saying higher interest rates will worsen inflation. Analysts believe that the current economic crisis may put an end to Erdogan's era if he doesn't control the situation, especially now that both the ruling party and opposition are preparing for the elections. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Made in Iran. This label is tagged on all of the 9,000 products showcased here in this exhibition that has the same title, Made in Iran. It's the 9th edition of the annual tech event that brings Iranian local producers under one roof in Tehran to promote their products. The products cover 14 industrial sectors, including oil and petrochemical industries, electricity, agriculture, and health. In addition to acting as an advertising platform for the participating companies, the expo is a hot marketplace where manufacturers can sell their products on the spot. In fact, it's a win-win deal for both customers and producers, because any product is sold with as much as 50% discount funded by Iran's Vice Presidency for Science and Technology, with the aim of supporting domestic production. Since the U.S.'s withdrawal from the 2015 deal and reinstatement of sanctions on Iran in 2018, Tehran has doubled down on its efforts to wean its economy off the ups and downs of politics. While the new Iranian government still believes in diplomacy, it says it will not tie the economy to the 2015 deal, and instead, it lends more support to domestic production.
Domestic production, as put by local brands here, will be the key to a resilient economy in Iran and a counterforce to U.S. sanctions that prevent Iranian industries from accessing foreign technology. Now it seems that the sanctions have given domestic production a boost here as the government seeks to drive the economy with made-in-Iran products. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Islamophobia is everywhere, making news on a regular basis. From the U.S.,
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
To to the halls of power in Europe.
Do I have a problem with Islam? Yes, I do have a problem with Islam.
Recently, this made headlines. Lauren Boebert joking about meeting fellow Congressman Ilhan Omar.
I look to my left, and there she is. Oh, Ilhan Omar. And I said, well, she doesn't have a backpack, we should be fine.
Muslim minorities everywhere are discussing solutions to the crisis. At the Islamophobia Awareness Conference organized by the Islamic Human Rights Commission based in London, the panel asked how much Muslim minorities can engage with their non-Muslim governments without compromising their faith.
Is our position one where we should engage in a kind of pragmatic way to just the ends justify the means? Or rather, do we follow, for theological reasons, a principled approach?
I would say, from my perspective, it's vital for diasporas, Muslim diasporas, the Ummah across the world, African and Caribbean diaspora, you have to engage.
Muslims are often forced to pledge allegiance to Western values in an overtly violent way. This is an old and primary tool of all oppressors to keep the oppressed occupied with the master's concerns. So refusing to do this can be powerful.
The depoliticization of mosques and the younger generation is a major concern. Efforts to prevent young people seeking justice and fighting oppression have intensified, raising the alarm.
There is a deliberate attempt to social engineer a type of Muslim which will not speak out, will be just obedient servant, will fit into the second-class citizenship which we all know is being promoted.
We asked conference moderator Professor Saeed Khan why such events matter.
Conferences like this are ones that help to then map out what is then not only the condition of Muslims, but to try to then understand where and how we place resources and strategies moving forward.
The far right is growing across Europe, manifesting in anti-immigration policies, bans on the Islamic dress code, and encouraging anti-Islam sentiment via the media and digital spaces. So these discussions have to be had if stereotypes targeting Muslims are to be confronted and deconstructed. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Mohammed once again tops the list for the most popular boy's name for newborns in the UK. According to parenting website Baby Centre, the name of Islam's holy prophet was the most popular name for boys in 2021, meaning the beloved Muslim name has held the top spot for the fifth year in a row. Sadly, British Muslims are living in an era of growing Islamophobia, and simply having a Muslim-sounding name could inspire discrimination. However, despite this, the name remains as popular as ever, and it's growing year upon year. So why do so many Muslim parents want to name their sons Mohammed? I asked a community leader to find out more.
When we pronounce the name of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, it is a full of barakah. And if you see the meaning of Muhammad literally, it means the you can say praise again praised, who, the person who is praised and whose praise is not coming to an end. So Muslims love their Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, hence they keep the name of their children Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And also there is many reward. If a person has the name Muhammad, peace be upon him, in the day of, you can say, judgment, God will say, you will enter paradise. He is not only for the Muslim. He is the mercy for the mankind. He is the, you can say, light for each and everyone. So this is our duty. I would like to request to our, you can say, people, those they are not aware about it, they must study.
Baby Center said the name also tops the website's most popular boy's name for the entire decade, while other high-ranking baby names for boys and girls in 2021 with Muslim connections include Fatima, Ali, and Layla, further cementing the theory that Islam could become the most successful religion in the Western world in the not-too-distant future. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution is in its fifth decade. The revolution put an end to centuries of monarchy and established the Islamic Republic as the new political system in Iran. Now, as the country is preparing to mark the 42nd anniversary of the triumph of the revolution, military and state officials have gathered in Tehran to lay out the roadmap for the upcoming 40 years, as part of a national plan called the Second Step of the Islamic Revolution.
From my point of view as a military commander, in the first 40 years of the revolution, Iran has taken greatest strides in the defense sector, moving from a mere consumer of foreign arms all the way to a producer of defense equipment. Now in the second phase of the revolution, we take it upon ourselves to turn into a military power by keeping abreast of the latest technologies.
2 years ago, and on the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, issued a statement titled The Second Phase, or The Second Step of the Islamic Revolution, which is viewed as the beginning of a new chapter in the life of the Islamic Republic.
The statement issued by the leader was a strategic roadmap not only for the Iranian nation, but for all freedom seekers in the world. It is a set of guidelines that instruct us to promote Islamic ideals across the globe. In my opinion, the most important part of it is the emphasis on science and technology. The leader urged us to excel in this arena, as science builds power, and this is what we have gathered here for.
The Islamic Revolution promised independence from world powers and freedom for Iranians. To this end, the country has tried to achieve self-sufficiency in different sectors. Military officials say, despite 4 decades of an all-out sanctions regime imposed by the U.S. on Iran's defense sector, the country has managed to indigenize its arms arsenal and build all the necessary military equipment needed to defend its sovereignty. The country has also managed to step in other key sectors, including space, nanotechnology, and medication.
Iranian officials say the Islamic Republic has fulfilled its promise of independence from the West and self-reliance on domestic capacities in the first phase of the revolution. They say it is now more resilient in the face of political and economic pressures and is ready to achieve higher goals in the second phase of the Islamic Revolution. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Israeli media revealed a new settlement project being advanced by Israel's Justice Ministry in East Al-Quds that would eventually push Palestinians out of their homes in several areas of the Holy City. According to the reports, the ministry's so-called custodian of absentee property is promoting new settlements and settler housing units in Sheikh Jarrah, Damascus Gate, near Beit Safafa, in Sur Baher, and in Beit Hanina. The custodian of absentee property takes possession of Palestinian properties whose owners Israel considers to reside outside the Palestinian territories, regardless of the fact that Palestinian families live in these homes since 1948 as tenants because they are not the original owners.
Israel continues to seize Palestinian properties under the so-called absentee law. It demolishes Palestinians' homes and properties. All this comes under the policy of ethnic cleansing and forcing Palestinians out of the holy city. It's part of their larger plan to achieve the dream of greater Al-Quds. But our people insist on their struggle and remain adherent to their inalienable rights.
Anti-settlement groups say if Israel succeeds in implementing the move, this will definitely entail the eviction of Palestinian residents, repeating the same scenario of the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. The groups accuse the Israeli regime of insisting on pushing Palestinians out of the Holy City, regardless of the consequences. They also inquire why the Israeli regime refuses to return these homes to their real owners instead of bringing in new settlers and expanding settlements.
If this is an absentee law, return back these people to their original houses, which is still there, still in the old city, still occupied by other Israeli settlers, Jews. So there is no justice in this, and this is like clearly this is in a kind of an occupation laws that they are targeting the indigenous and the people of the city.
Today, there are about 500,000 Israeli settlers living in the occupied West Bank, with almost 250,000 more living in Al-Quds settlements, which are considered in violation of international law. Palestinians angrily wonder how the Israeli laws allow the Jewish settlers to take over their properties under numerous claims. But at the same time, this right is denied to the real owners, the Palestinians, who have been forced out of their assets in 1948, ever since Israel's establishment. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Okay.
EU foreign affairs ministers gathered in Brussels on Monday for their final scheduled meeting of 2021. They accused Moscow of massing troops near Ukraine's border in preparation for a possible invasion.
The ministers, all of them, has been very clear today that any aggression against Ukraine will come with political consequences and with a high economic cost for Russia.
Moscow denies it intends to invade Ukraine and accuses Kiev of Western-backed provocation. Many analysts say the EU's undying support for Ukraine is nothing short of scandalous. Just last September, the European Court of Auditors, the 27-nation bloc's financial watchdog, published a report showing that corruption in Ukraine is rife at the highest levels amongst politicians, the judiciary and state-owned enterprises. The report states that since 2014, EU taxpayers have sent 12.5 billion euro to Kiev via the European Commission, but corruption reform efforts have failed.
New sanctions against Russia being considered by the EU include travel bans and asset freezes targeting politicians. The Federation's banking sector could be hit. Perhaps the new gas pipeline between Russia and Germany might be blocked from becoming operational. The Kremlin has warned against further provocation. Despite all the rhetoric, analysts point out that the EU and Russia are major trading partners, particularly in the area of energy.
I think that the very existence of this strong economic interconnectivity is encouraging to look for the ways for the better political relations.
Those relations are currently at an all-time low and will be the subject of much debate when EU leaders hold a summit here in the Belgian capital. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip: what are the secrets of reminding oneself when it comes to the enhancement and the optimization of our servitude to Allah, our ubudiyya? So, dear listeners, one of the most important things that a person who wants to increase and enhance their ubudiyya is to constantly remind oneself of course, various things. For example, one of the things that we are suggested to remember and we are advised to remember is death. The fact that all of these seemingly materialistic and worldly pleasures that, again, seemingly we believe they will last forever, they won't. They will end at one point. Other things that we are advised and suggested to remember, again, in order to enhance and optimize our ubudiyya, is that we must remember the Day of Judgment, the day of Qiyamah, when all of our actions and our deeds, whether good or bad, will be brought to a court of divine justice and they will be weighed, and the final verdict on one's hereafter is made. Another thing that we are constantly asked to remember and we are constantly asked to remind ourselves, of course, is the fact that the world is a temporary residing place, whereas the hereafter is the permanent residing place of every human being. And so, of course, each one of these things has their own explanations. For example, the first one that we talked about was the reminder of death. The second one was the reminder of the hereafter. And the third one is the reminder of the actuality, the reality of both this world and the next. So very quickly talking about reminding ourselves of